call the House Judiciary together, 5 minutes after 1. I think today's the 28th. If you would, call the roll, please.
Yes. Representative Miller.
Excused.
Representative Frick.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg.
Here.
Representative Foster.
Here.
Representative Ledoux.
Here.
Representative Lynn.
Here.
Representative Keller.
Here. Thank you. What we're going to do today, but before I get started, and if I may repeat this, in fact, because I think it's really important, I just want to make a statement about SB 64. That's a committee priority. We've done a lot of work on it. There's been a lot of work done on it in the Senate, so I want to make sure that we all know what's coming. So we're going to start today. We're shooting for 2 o'clock to get on to that, take any remaining public testimony, and maybe time for some committee discussion. And then at Monday at 2 o'clock, it would be the same pattern. We'll hear the other bills on the schedule first, but when it comes to SB 64, we'll try to hit that as close as we can to 2 o'clock. And before the end of that time on Monday, what I'm going to do is try to shoot for closing public testimony and, I'm for sure giving time for the committee to do some work. And then here's the important thing. By 2 o'clock on Tuesday, next Tuesday, I want all amendments in, and run them through Ledge Legal. Anything, if you're contemplating an amendment to SB 64, get them to us. It'll all be part of the packets, and everybody will have a time to look ahead. If they're not brought to the office by 2 o'clock, we may not accept them. And the reason for that is because there has been so much testimony and everything that we're just trying to be efficient. And the goal, frankly, is on Wednesday, depending on how big the stack of amendments is, we'll have to see that when we get to it, we'll act on it. And it'll be up-down motions. So I'm just asking you to have your homework done. Or, we'll have a fair dialogue as far as speaking on it, but we'll probably only be able to speak once, and then we'll decide on the amendments. I would assume that the committee won't be unanimous on every amendment that comes up. And so I'm just asking and appealing to you to do your homework and have it ready to go. So then on Wednesday, if time allows, we'll start with SB 164 at 1 o'clock on Wednesday. But if time allows, my goal, is to give opportunity for the bill to move or not on Wednesday, depending on the will of the committee. Another thing in the way of announcements, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock on the floor, I said 9:30, and so I want to make sure you're clear.
9 o'clock.
Okay. 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, a joint judiciary meeting in room 519 upstairs, and it's on tax and regulation related to marijuana, that initiative. And then at 1:30, we meet again, and that's about the minimum wage initiative. So we'll be getting testimony in those two arenas. For today, we have several bills ahead of us, and again, we're going to move to SB 64
Mr. Chair.
At 2 o'clock, as close as we can. Representative Grunberg?
I just have one question.
Sure.
And it's kind of serving notice. We put in our bill on unlawful evasion. I don't think it's been read across, but it's my intention, with the Chair's permission, since it is a committee bill, to see if the prosecutors and the defense are okay with it, and talking to the bill sponsor, and see if that could be taken as an amendment to the crime bill.
Okay,
I'm just kind of letting people know.
We will, we will look at that and see if we can make it happen. That would be definitely the efficient way to do it. So, thank you. Good.
It hasn't been read across yet. I assume it will be on Monday or something.
Right. Okay.
That was kind of a question.
Today we have, we're going to start with HB 235, and that's a sponsor, Representative Higgins. And you heard that, the committee heard that bill on the Friday that I wasn't here. So the version that was in front of us was a State Affairs Committee, and what we have being presented here is a blank CS version Y Yankee. We will just ask the sponsor to introduce to us, and we'll set it aside. We have no plan on action today, but we want to get it in our homework pile, and that's the intent. So make sure, if you would, that you have version Y in front of you, and if you would give me a motion to...
I want to be sure I have it, Mr. Chair.
To put that bill in front of us.
Mr. Chair, I would move for CS for HB 235Y for discussion and for adoption.
I'll object.
Version Y, it looks like.
Okay, for discussion and introduction purposes, version Y is in front of us, and you can find it. If you can't find it, get Ernest signal for him for help.
You want for the record an objection?
Doesn't matter to me. It's just for introduction and presentation, so.
I'll object just so we have it.
Yeah. Okay. Are we good?
Yeah, we are good, sir. If you would identify yourself for the record and tell us what's in CS for HB 235 version Yankee.
Well, this should be relatively painless to the committee. I'm Representative Pete Higgins from District 5. We have before you HB 235, and my good Chief of Staff, Tom Studler, will go through the changes for you quickly, and then you guys can move on with your business.
For the record, my name is Tom Studler. I am staff for Representative Pete Higgins from District 5, and if I might point you to the explanation of changes that we have in this blank CS. First off, there is a title change where we added establishing sanctions for persons who file false complaints or frivolous complaints that are in bad faith with the commission. In section 1, we added a new paragraph to AS 1513-045 that the proceedings relating to the investigation are confidential until it's determined that a violation has occurred. In section 2, we amend AS 1513-380B by adding that except for the extent that the confidentiality provisions are waived by the subject, the complainant shall keep confidential the fact that they have filed a complaint under this section, as well as the contents of the complaints filed. If the complaint violates any provision of the confidentiality, the commission shall immediately dismiss the complaint. However, the dismissal of a complaint does not affect the right of the commission or any other person to initiate a complaint based on the same factual information. Section 3, we added a new subsection by amending 1513-380G, and in that section we added that you may appeal the decision of the commission to the superior court by either the complainant or the respondent within 30 days of their decision. Section 4, we went on with AS 1530, adding a new paragraph L, amending it by adding that the complaint and all documents relating to the investigation are confidential until it has been determined that a violation has occurred. We went on by adding a new paragraph M to further define that within 30 days after accepting the complaint, the commission shall determine whether the facts substantiate an alleged allegation and whether there is credible evidence for further investigations and proceedings are then warranted, and that the commission may delegate this duty to make that determination to an employee slash investigator of the commission to expedite this so that we have it done in a timely manner. Section 5 is basically the same thing as 1530, but we're talking to AS 3950055, and the same language appears there, and that the commission needs to make a determination based on the facts before them whether the allegation has merit, and that language is in there as well. One of the things that we added in here is that upon making a that if you make a false claim, and indulge me for just a moment, that if the commission or the commission's employees determines by clear and convincing evidence that a person filed a complaint under this section knowing that the material statements in that complaint are false, they filed it with reckless disregard for whether the statements in the complaint are true, or they filed a complaint that is frivolous, vexatious, or is otherwise in bad faith, the commission shall dismiss the complaint and order the complainant to reimburse the respondent for his costs and court costs. Also, they shall order the complainant to reimburse the commission for their time that they spent conducting this investigation under false pretense. And also that the commission at that point may decline to consider any further complaints filed by that particular individual. It also authorizes that those orders by the commission are not exclusive and do not preclude any other remedies or rights or actions that are subject to the complaint may have against them for civil proceedings. The intent of that is to make sure that protecting the process of APOC is that when complaints are brought forward, they're brought forward in good faith, that they have merit, and that they proceed forward and do what the commission was intended to do. Thank you.
A question from Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much for bringing the bill forward. I have a question. If you have, say, a complaint with multiple allegations, let's say six allegations, and say one of the six allegations is deemed to be frivolous, and then according to the bill, they would take certain steps to recoup some of the cost. But what if the other five are deemed not to be frivolous? You see what I'm trying to say? I'm not saying it well.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I understand what you're saying. I think that at that point, what one would have to do, and I hesitate to speak for the commission, but I would think that if a complaint was brought forward that had multiple allegations to it, and three of the five had merit, and there was clear and convincing, there was credible
and
evidence
some
that there was a violation, that those would go forward. The other two would not, but the other three would.
Representative Lynn, a follow-up?
Well, what I meant was, if you have a couple that are, in fact, frivolous, or deemed to be frivolous at least, then the state, APOC, and so on, would be reimbursed. But some of them are frivolous and some are not.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, if I understand you correctly on that, if a person files a complaint with five allegations on there and three of them are upheld and one's not, I think then you would have to look at the clear and convincing evidence that whether they filed it in bad faith, and since three of the five were upheld, I would have to say that would not be in bad faith because there was merit to those cases. So there would be... I do not want to speak for the commission.
Well, as we go forward, Mr. Chair, I'd like to get that clarified.
Yeah, and we have Paul DeFinius online, and I will give him an opportunity to see if he wants. He's the executive director of Alaska APOC, and we'll give him a chance to respond, and then Representative Ledoux has a question. Paul, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any, have you thought that through, or is that a question you want to answer, you want to bring back for a future hearing? We're getting a presentation on the bill. Did you hear the question?
Mr. Chair, if you're referring to Representative Lynn's question, yes, I did. I'm not authorized to speak for the commission, and in general, we try not to deal with hypotheticals. So if I could, I'd like to refrain from answering at this point.
Representative Ledoux?
So I guess I'm kind of wondering, if a complaint is dismissed and then the complainant decides to file an appeal, and the complainant files an appeal with the Superior Court, then are all records of the Superior Court, are they sealed? Because normally you file something in the Superior Court and that's, you know, that's totally open. But if the whole idea is that things are supposed to be not public until there's been a decision that it is, let's say, that the defendant or the respondent has violated an APOC rule, what are you going to do with the Superior Court?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. That is an excellent question, and I will get back to you on that with an answer. That is an excellent question. Thank you so much for bringing that forward. Thank you.
So with that, we're going to – Representative Foster, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the explanation of changes in Section 4, it says that all documents relating to an investigation are confidential until it's determined that a violation has occurred. So if no violation occurs, is there any provision that maybe the documents – do you become open, but maybe not for, say, a period of time, 6 months or something? That way it's not something that could affect an election, if, say, an election's just about to happen in 30 days or something? Or
through the chair, Representative Foster, to be honest with you, if there was no merit to a violation, we hadn't thought that to that particular aspect of the bill of making those records public at that time. I would have to get back with you, sir.
Okay, thanks.
You know, if I could speak to that, it would be, this is Representative Higgins, and to through the chair to Representative Foster, it would be, I guess, my intent or my thoughts would be, if there was no merit to the allegation and it was dismissed, then I don't see any reason why it would have to be public information to begin with, other than if you're just nosy and you just want to see something. I mean, the whole purpose behind this is for only merit or, violations that actually have merit that become public. And that's the purpose behind this bill, is that. The integrity of your name. I get the fact that maybe it's good. You're thinking that maybe for historical reasons you want to put it in there. But as an individual and a citizen of the state, I don't see where that would be. But I can't speak for the commission or of that issue, because we really haven't thought about that. I just, common sense would say it shouldn't be.
Right.
Representative Lynn?
What about the defendant themselves, and they've been basically exonerated? Could they themselves request that it become public so that they could show what a rotten you-know-what is to file this complaint and use it themselves?
Through the chair, in our statute, there is a provision in there that basically says that if you want to waive your rights, you can have all of it public if you'd like. You could do that.
Thank you.
Representative Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking, and I totally understand that, that side of it. And my thinking was also that if there is nothing wrong, then, I think people out there might say, well, we want to know what happened. And so maybe in the interest of transparency, we would say, well, if you want to know, then, sometime down the road, we're willing to open that up. But if people are trying to use this as a tactic before an election, then we don't want to allow that. So just something to think about. I don't feel strongly one way or another on that, though, but I was just curious. So thank you.
Representative Greenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With a little latitude from the chair, I've talked with Tom about this bill extensively and a little less with Representative Higgins. And I'm kind of taking this opportunity because this is the only APOC bill we're likely to see this year. And I have a couple of concerns, and I'm considering a couple of amendments, and I kind of wanted to at least put it out so folks know what I'm thinking of here. When the APOC, and this is kind of to Mr. Dauphiné as well, so he knows what's going on. When they did their report, their APOC report this year, and it was dated January of 2014, they made one suggestion for a legislative change. And the members will recall that we used to have to do a post-election 10-day report. And this is at page 20 and following of the report, and at appropriate time we'll probably give it out. And they're suggesting we reinstitute that because it requires that people review their contributions and expenditures that occurred in a flurry a few days before the election. And as it is now, there's no post-election report for months. And so huge $100,000 fines accrue. And if we did a simple report to recap that 10 days after, that would probably catch a lot of these things and bring those potential fines back into line. And I'm not really asking, I'm kind of a, unless somebody wants to say something, I'm just kind of putting on notice that I'm having an amendment I may offer to deal with that. And the second thing, Mr. Chair, if I may, is I was involved in some litigation on behalf of somebody else in my role as a member of the bar, looking at the tension between a particular statute and the rule. And the statute is AS 15 15.13.390A, which states that if you violate the law by not having a properly completed and certified report and it's late, or you miss something, it's subject to a civil penalty of not more than $500 a day. APOC has drafted a regulation, 2AAC50.855, that states in relevant part, the amount of the penalty must be determined by multiplying the applicable daily maximum penalty set out by the number of days the report was later incomplete. It changes a maximum into a benchmark and results in huge unfair fines. And I'm looking at possibly doing something we don't do, and that would be disapproving the regulation in the statute and putting down what we want it to be so that there's a maximum and a benchmark, and that they're not confused, because it's terrifically unjust. And what they have to do now is apply mitigators that really don't apply, just to bring this back into line. And I've talked to Tom about this and Representative Higgins, and I'm just kind of putting this on notice now.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. And Paul, I'm assuming you took note of that, and when we get back to this bill, you can give us some insight, on the amount and the number of times the fines have happened and what's going on there. But did you have something, Representative Pruitt?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I actually would like to just clarify, ask for clarification from Representative Gruenberg on the first piece that he brought forward, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. You were indicating, because we have the daily reports, if it's over $250, the 10 days before, I believe it's 10 days, 10 or 7, you're indicating that we should have a report right after, or maybe we used to, and should go back to having a report, like, I don't know, a week, two after the election, something like that, instead of the 45 days after election. Or no, not even 45 days. It's February 15th. It's the year-end one, right?
It's through the chair. It would not eliminate the year-end. It would be in addition to. We used to have to do this, and then we simply repealed it because it was extra work, and people said, why should we do it? We roll it into our year-end report. Well, the result has been, and we've had one election cycle, and a number of people have gotten hit with huge fines because they screwed up in some manner and didn't have a proper report on the 24-hour report or something like that. And it wasn't caught for 3 months later, because people don't look at this stuff until they do their next report. And the APOC made a specific recommendation that we reinstitute it, because it'll make people triple check, and then this will be caught and will get corrected and will eliminate the fine that would have occurred for 2.5 months. It would only be for like a 10-day period or something like that. It's to help the candidates. And I'll pass this out. This is just following what the commission itself recommended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ledoux, if it's on point, please make it very brief. We have.
Can I direct it again to Representative Gruenberg?
No. If you want to dialogue on that question, please do it. Later, because our intent is not to move the bill today. And this is issues that have to be worked out with the sponsor. So we're just going to stop there. I don't mean to be rude, and I apologize, but
no problem.
Just trying to keep the time. So what we're going to do is set this bill aside under bills previously heard. And the sponsor and several members of the committee have some communication to do, and that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a matter of housekeeping, Representative Pruitt joined us. He's already on the record, so I guess I don't need to say that. That's all right. He's joined us. Repetitive for you, Representative Pruitt. I just pointed out that Monday we'll meet again on SB 64. We'll try to hit 2 o'clock time, just like we've been doing. By 2 o'clock on Tuesday, though, have any potential amendments that you have for SB 64 done in legal services and to my office. And then on Wednesday, we'll start with SB 64 at 1 o'clock with an eye toward acting on the amendments and potentially moving the bill if we're ready for that.
And then also I remind everybody about the time change tomorrow. I announced on the floor 9:30 for joint judiciary. The time is 9 o'clock in room 519. So if you're late, don't consider yourself briefed. Now that I said it twice, we got it. Okay, what we're going to do now is go into the next bill that we had. Actually, it's the first one I think we had on the schedule that everybody saw, but it's HB 205, and that is sponsored by Representative Foster and Representative Lynn. And we'll look at this and see where we're at, see what the questions are, and we can proceed as the committee sees fit. But as I understand it, Representative Lynn has an amendment that he wants to make, and we want to get it done before this public testimony, so that the if we have public testimony on this, that they will know that is in there. So, Representative Lynn, do you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Amendment 1, and that would be on page 2, line 1. You delete misdemeanor and insert an infraction, and it's punishable for a fine not to exceed $500.
And I'll go ahead and object for purposes of explanation, but I also, in that objection, want to point out that we're working off of version uniform, isn't it? Or is it Papa? What is it here? Help me out.
Just a parliamentary inquiry.
Representative Greenberg?
Your amendment is labeled U.1. Is that the one we're looking at?
That's the one I have, yes, sir.
Thank you.
So that'd be version U that we have in front of us, and it's a sponsor, it's a sponsor substitute. So
we're looking at the uniform version, is that?
Okay, Representative, I know you told us where it goes and what it is, but do you have anything else you want to add?
Well, no, except that a misdemeanor, school zones, be a very hazardous area, but nonetheless, misdemeanor is probably over the top for what that could result in. And so bringing it down to an infraction by a fine not to exceed $500, that brings it in line with any other infraction that might occur, and there's flexibility for a judge or somebody when it says not to exceed.
Okay. Representative Ledoux?
I would also like to point out, I think I'm correct here, that if you've got a misdemeanor rather than an infraction, that a misdemeanor would give you the right to a trial by jury, and I don't think an infraction would, and that a misdemeanor would probably also give you the right, if you qualify the income guidelines for a public defender, I don't think an infraction would, and so it could end up as costly to the state and the municipalities for those reasons, if you leave it as a misdemeanor.
Representative Lynn.
Right now, you get to say a traffic ticket for speeding in a school zone. What is that? Is that not a misdemeanor? A misdemeanor, or infraction, or a ticket?
Representative Ledoux, do you know?
My gut reaction is it's a ticket. I don't think it's a misdemeanor.
I suppose eventually I could amend the amendment to make it similar to any other traffic ticket a person might get in a particular place like a school zone.
Representative Foster, your staff has the answer, and I think it would be good. We did not. I wanted to get this on the record, for the testimony part, and so that's all we're doing right now. We don't. So let's save that question if we can, and if you're going to present the bill, come on up at this time. I'll remove my objection on the amendment. But is there anybody else that wants to further object? If not, then
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg.
Before we take a vote on the amendment, and I'm not saying I object at all, but I think maybe we need to get a couple of these questions answered, if you don't mind.
Representative Grunberg, if there's further questions, we'll make a further amendment later on. So
that's fine.
We're just getting the presentation now.
Okay.
So if you would, Representative Foster, introduce yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Neil Foster for House District 39, and with me I have my Chief of Staff, Paula Bowl, and before we speak to the amendment, which my chief of staff can do, I just wanted to make a brief opening comment. HB 205 is an act relating to traffic offenses committed in a school zone and prohibiting lanes in a school zone. I'd like to first recognize, of course, Bob Lynn here for helping us and to strengthen this bill and adding the section regarding changing of lanes. Now, what prompted our office to look at the issue of traffic safety near schools was unfortunately a tragedy that occurred in 2011. A boy named Jameson Miles Lee Thruin had just moved with his family from Nome to Fairbanks, and while waiting for his brother at a street corner right next to the school, he was struck and killed by someone who was under the influence of prescription medications and was speeding through the intersection. The family of Jameson Thruin will be testifying, and I'd like to let you hear their story in their own words, and I am wearing a button with his picture here. What I'd like to impress upon you is this caused us to think about what can be done to make our schools and our children safer. And many of you have probably seen the sections of highway that are subject to double fines when construction workers are at work. And so we asked ourselves, why wouldn't we afford that same level of protection to our youngest and our most vulnerable? So this bill is very simple. It says two things. First, drivers who speed through school zones will be subject to double fines. And second, drivers may not change lanes in a school zone that is equipped with a flashing light if the light is flashing. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to make the introduction, and my chief of staff can speak to the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paula Bowles, staff to Representative Foster. Traffic fines are dealt with, such as speeding, as mentioned by Representative Lynn, are considered violations, and violations and infractions are treated by the court equally. They're both considered minor infractions. And I can continue with a sectional summary if that's what the committee would like.
I have a question for you then, Paul. From your perspective, the amendment that we made to the bill is appropriate if we want to make it an infraction of a lesser amount. Do you think we're on target there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and we have discussed this with the courts, and it does seem in line with the remainder of the bill.
Great. Okay, thanks. What are you going to do? Nothing. Is there any other questions for the sponsor?
So, Mr. Chair, I want to just a little bit on the changing lanes piece. I'm thinking, for example, Minnesota Drive, right as it kind of turns into L Drive in Anchorage, and I know you're from Nome, but I think you're familiar with it, some of the Anchorage area, goes underneath the bridge there beside Roman Junior High. And that, at times, is a school zone. And there's about three lanes on each side. It can very easily get backed up in that area. If they're not allowed to change lanes and it gets backed up because of the busyness going on there, I don't know. Is that something that we want to necessarily kind of do and not allow them to change lanes in what is essentially a street? And I know why they're slowing it down, and it's appropriate that they're slowing it down because the kids will cross over there. But now we potentially could put someone who's just kind of changing lanes to, maybe they started off in the middle and, oops, I didn't do it soon enough, but I need to turn over ahead to the airport. But they're in that school zone area. Now they could be potentially in trouble for with a infraction here. Just a real world example. Just curious if
Representative Foster and then Representative Lynn.
Thank you. And actually, that's a very good question, because we just had this discussion right before our meeting here, and I could probably summarize, but maybe I should let Representative Lynn speak to that.
Thank you very much. Originally, well, first of all, some background. The school zone that I go through most frequently is on Lake Otis, and occasionally on Minnesota. And sometimes I contemplate a citizen's arrest going there, because I religiously do not exceed 20, I'm usually 17 or 18 miles per hour if the situation presents itself. And I have the great urge, people pass me like I'm tied to a post and going in and out of the lane changes and so on, and I've even contemplated citizen's arrest on a thing because it really irritates me. And of course, it's a public safety hazard, you know, to our most vulnerable of the population. And so originally I had contemplated a bill on that, on passing in a school zone and or changing lanes in a school zone. Well, we decided that it'd be too unwieldy on the passing in the school zone. I might explore that at some point in the future. But then you have these people who changing lanes. And so Reverend Foster came forward with this HB 205, which I think is a very good bill. And I admit, I thought this is a good opportunity not to have another bill, but to include in this bill, because it's basically the same subject, safety in a school zone. And so he was gracious enough to put this into the bill for me. Then upon further reflection, I started thinking, and others did too, to Reverend Pruitt's concern there. I would still like to have that if we can figure out a way to make it practical. On a four-lane road, you might have to make a, you didn't anticipate one up, you have to change lanes to make a right turn, you know, or left turn, I suppose. So what do you do about that? Well, I guess some way that could be detailed out. Maybe it could be changed to on a two-lane road. On a two-lane road, obviously, you're going to have to go over in the oncoming traffic lane to make the pass, and that is hazardous within the school zone or not. So if we cannot figure a practical way to deal with this, narrow it down, I'd be willing to offer an amendment to move Section 2 until we can figure out what to do with it. Now, I don't want to, this is a very good bill, and I don't want to impede the progress of this bill. But if anybody in the committee or anybody else can come up with a potential solution to this, I would appreciate it. Again, you know, safety is paramount. That's what this whole bill is about.
Representative Ledoux has a comment before you do. Keep it in the context of the fact that we'll put this bill aside and leave room for work and cleaning this stuff up. Representative Ledoux.
Well, I asked my question in the context of I'm a really lousy driver, so I really don't know the answer to this question. I mean, is changing?
On the record.
It's okay. Anybody who's ever driven with me knows that that's correct.
I don't drive.
Is changing lanes just because you're in a school zone, is that inherently dangerous? I mean, I understand what you're talking about, driving over the speed limit and wiggling in and out and everything. But, I mean, can't you just drive along at the rate of speed that you're supposed to be and, you know, looking around and being cautious and everything and still change lanes? I mean, is changing lanes in and of itself when you're talking about two or three or even four lanes sometimes, is that always inherently dangerous?
Just put me in the queue.
Okay, we got Representative Lynn. Okay, that means we have to do some housekeeping here. Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, and then Representative Foster. And I'm going to apologize right now to Representative Isaacson. We can do nothing more than get the bill on the record under bills previously heard, and I think that's of limited value to do that. And we have three at least online to testify on this bill. So I do have to apologize. Sometimes that happens this time of the season, and I'm really sorry. So. That means that we will not be getting to HB 282 today. For those that anybody that came to testify on that was the one on the tenant landlord laws, and we'll get back to that as soon as we can. So, I'm sorry, Representative Lynn.
Changing lanes is inherently more dangerous than not changing lanes, staying in the same lane. That's any place, but in a school zone, it'd be. More dangerous, it would seem to me. The fewer times you change lanes, typically, the better off it is, you know, whenever we drive. So, you know, that's what I'm concerned about. And then they're changing lanes as you and I might attempt to do it, and those people who just weave in and out. And that, of course, that could be covered in another section also, I realize, as reckless driving. Or whatever whatever they call it in Alaska.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things. First of all, for the members' information, the amendment we've just adopted, number one, was an infraction and is punishable by a fine not to exceed $500. The term infraction in Title 28 is defined in AS 28.90.010, subsections C and D. But the maximum fine, according to that, is $300. And I just wanted it on the record that everybody knew that this particular infraction would be a different amount of the fine than the normal infraction. I just wanted to put that on the record. Number two, and at some point when we take the bill up again, we can answer this. I don't know if there's an inconsistency between the other two sections and Section 2, because the other two sections delegate to the Supreme Court the responsibility of setting the fine schedule. And it says that if you're doing it in a traffic safety corridor, it should be double the amount normally of the normal bail or whatever it is, fine. And we're adding school zone to that. And here we're putting this particular crime as an infraction, and I don't know how that would be reconciled with the other two sections of the bill, and I would just ask Paul and Representative Foster to take a look at that. And the third thing is, and I don't mean to sound like an old fogey here, but my first term in the legislature in 1985 and 86, we dealt with something similar, and it was a very thorny problem, and we put it aside in the HES committee for the whole interim, and I worked on it, and we came up with a solution. The question was there, how to effectively prosecute somebody who passes a school bus when the school bus is stopped and the arms are out and the lights are flashing. And in Alaska, which is cold and dark in the winter, you can't tell who's driving the car. And the car is gone, and the school bus driver is trying to watch the children and may get the license number. And it was effectively impossible to prosecute. Something like that might occur here. You're in a school zone, you got a crossing guard who's trying to watch the kids, and they see a car zoom by, and they're lucky if they get the license number. What we finally did, Mr. Chair, was to take a Minnesota law that said, if you can identify and prove the owner of the car, there shall be a civil penalty assessed against the owner. And I'd have to look it up. It was a Dave Thompson bill, if you get it in basis, and we can look it up. And we set out the amount of the civil penalty. And if the owner of the car comes forth and identifies the driver and says it was not her, but it was a driver, then they'd prosecute the driver and the civil penalty would be abated. But it was a kind of a similar problem, and that's how we did it. We worked with the school bus drivers and everybody, and it passed. And I don't know if that's of any help to you in your dealing with this.
Okay. It's a little outside of the scope, I think, of what was considered, so and the sponsor will consider that come forward. So. Seeing no other questions at this time, let's go to public testimony. If you like, you can join us back up here. And, Paul, if you like, stay there in case there's some questions that get raised that you may want to speak to. That'd be fine. Let's start with, if you don't like, you can go back there and sit, too. I'm not trying to talk you into anything here. Let's start with Cussie Cower, is it, in Nome?
Hello?
Are you calling in to testify on House Bill 205?
Yes, this is Cussie Cower.
Okay. Give us your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. My name is Caroline Reeder Cower, born in the territory of Nome and known out here on Seward Peninsula as Cussy. I thank our representative Neil Foster and Lynn for bringing forward the proposed changes to state statute, which would include school zones as a place which qualifies as part of the traffic offenses, resulting in double bail, double fines. The driving population in our state needs to be educated and aware that when one puts our children at risk by bad driving behavior, the consequences are now more severe through the passage of House Bill 205. I would like to present my testimony today as that of the voice of Jameson Thrun, fourth generation Alaskan and an 11-year-old student at University Park Elementary, Fairbanks, Alaska. Please take a moment to write down his name. Jameson. A bright, sunny August morning, me and my little brother, Caden, were walking to school, and Caden forgot his soccer ball. I told him to go back home and get it. I would wait for him. He started running back to our house, and I heard the screaming of tires. That day, August 30th, 2011, changed the lives of our family, my daughter, Kelly. Her husband, her children, and those of many across Alaska, as we mourn the instant killing of Jameson just 15 days after he left Nome for his new Fairbanks home. Caden returned with his soccer ball and witnessed his brother lying in the grass while EMTs prepared him for the ambulance. He put his hand over his eyes as he passed by and ran the rest of the way to school. And in shock, waited for his big brother, Jameson, who would never come. Jameson had plans for a new life. In his new home, at his new school, in his new town, but he died on the streets of Fairbanks on his way to school. He wanted to play football. He had just gotten a new trampoline 2 days earlier. I know Jameson is in heaven and his mother is missing him terribly. Jameson had plans, and I assure you, residing in Birch Hill Cemetery was not part of them. Parents should expect when their child leaves home for school in the morning, the next time they will see them that evening is at the supper table, not laying opened up on an operating table. Highway work zones involve men and women exposed to an element of risk and danger as they are performing their work tasks, sometimes only protected by a hard hat, vulnerable to the driving behaviors of fellow Alaskans and the public. The same care and caution should be exercised by drivers where there are high concentrations of our most precious, which include school zones, school yards, and school drop drive-throughs. While this bill does not address these other properties by passing HB 205 and amending current statute, it is one small step down a long path I intend to take with the help of all of you and on behalf of my grandson, Jameson Thrun. I have many other suggestions to offer and can be contacted via email at cussy@nome.net, Facebook. I am listed in the phone directory or at P.O. Box 715 in Nome. 99762. Again, I thank all of you for your public service and your time today.
Thank you, Connie. We all feel terrible about your loss. whether or not we act on the bill, of course, all of us are sobered, and we will certainly, I'm sure anyone that hears your testimony will be really thoughtful when they see the school zone sign. So thank you for your testimony. Randy Hahn, you're online from the state troopers for questions, but I was wondering if you had anything you wanted to add to clarify questions that you may have heard come up?
No, sir, not at this time. I'm happy to answer any specific questions that may be directed my way, but I don't have anything else to add.
Okay, thank you. Connie McKenzie, come up. From Department of Transportation, I think I've heard of that place.
Small little place. Good afternoon. My name is Connie McKenzie, and I'm the legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation. And I was coming before you today to let you know that the department is preparing a fiscal note on this. And I apologize for not getting in earlier in reviewing the bill. My thoughts went to enforcement and fines and forgot about the signage aspect of it. So as the bill directs, there would be signage on the flashing lights to indicate that there would be no turning within the flashing areas of the school zone. And then there would also be signage indicating the start and end of a double fine zone. And so as you're holding the bill over, we will get the fiscal note in as soon as possible, and I can give you just some rough estimates if the committee would like. So
Representative Lynn has a question.
Would the fiscal note be different if you do have the no change in lane in the school zone, or if we do not have that?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, our fiscal note would change because part of the signage is addressing the no turn, no turn zone.
If I may, but it would be the same. But it would be some kind of fiscal note either way, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Foster.
Would it be, thank you, Mr. Chairman, possible to do the fiscal note with just the double fines and then one with the double fine and the changing of lanes in case the changing of lanes is pulled out?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Foster, we could break out in the analysis section what it would look like, what each part looks like for you. We'll do that.
Connie, have you looked at yet, if you're just now preparing a fiscal note, probably not, but I mean, how many school zones are we talking about where the turn is even possible? I'm sure that's part of the calculation, but have you looked at that at all?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we have looked at that. We've estimated the number of school zones, and based on the number of schools and a multiplying factor, because there are often more than one school zone around the school, depending on how many streets would be considered school zones around the school. Let me see if I have the number. We believe there were approximately 168 school zones. And that's statewide, and the state would not be responsible for ones that aren't on state roads. So we've also kind of narrowed that down as well.
And I'm sure that information will be part of the fiscal note that's forthcoming.
Correct.
I see no other questions. Mark, did you have something you wanted to add?
I did not, unless there were specific questions.
Okay.
Available for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Connie. Okay, well, we'll set this bill aside, and we'll let the sponsor work out details. And thank you for bringing the bill forward. And we're actually pretty close on time. I don't think I was too mean to get here, but we have SB 64. In front of us again, and I think where we left off, we had was it a public defender, but he evidently hasn't called in. We have Nancy Mead for questions only in the room. If nobody calls in here in a few minutes, we may actually get out of committee early. We can continue on with the other bill if you're still available. So sit tight, it might happen. But we'll see here. Let's take a little of ease until we find out if we're going to get a call. Several waiting to testify. And I'm going to start with Rick Allen, who is on to just to answer questions. But Rick, we really cut you short in the last time, and I want to give you opportunity, if you like, to finish or expand on your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really don't have anything else to add at this time, unless the committee has specific questions.
No, I don't see any questions, so that's great. So then we'll go to Tony Piper.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm here just to answer questions if anybody has any.
And who do you represent?
I'm with the Department of Health and Social Service. I'm the ASAP program manager, the Alcohol Safety Action Program.
I should have known that. But when I saw ASAP, I had to ask because I couldn't remember. Okay, great. Bill Mickelson from 24/7 South Dakota, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me?
We loud and clear, sir.
I'm calling from South Dakota. By way of background, 9 years ago, working with then Attorney General Larry Long, I helped develop, implement, and then direct the 24/7 sobriety program. I now am retired after 43 years in law enforcement, and I have a consulting company, and it's my specialty is just migrating the 24/7 sobriety program across the United States and abroad. And I've been asked to by Wendy Chamberlain to call in and just offer a few general comments about the language and the amendment that's being offered. And I think it's a valuable tool to have 24/7 available as a tool in the toolbox for judges and for driver's license division to be able to do driver's license reinstatements for revocations and suspensions as a result of a DUI conviction. It's been a valuable tool in South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and all the other states where we're operating. And I applaud the efforts of the committee. I've been able to do a review of Senate Bill 64 and just a cursory review of the amendment that's being offered. But I applaud your effort for having a very comprehensive bill that you guys are shepherding through the process.
And if you would, go ahead and tell us a little bit about the amendments in your time to testify here. As I understand it, and I've been told that we have two basic amendments pending, and I don't really I haven't read them and looked at them thoroughly, but one of them, I think, is to extend the temporary driving license option to misdemeanor DUIs, and I think the other one has to do with felony DUI license. But if you can clarify so the committee can be thinking about that, because we're going to be making a decision potentially on those amendments as they come forward.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg has
a question. Just a parliamentary inquiry. I don't seem to have those. Do we have? Have they been given out? Oh, okay.
Go ahead and anything you want to talk about, feel free there on that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Again, my comments are just general comments because I haven't had a chance to really drill into the amendment that's going to be offered. But the language is consistent with other states using 24/7 twice a day testing as an option over the ignition interlock devices. I don't know if you're aware of this, but we were successful in a federal highway bill in marking up that bill to include the 24/7 sobriety program, so we now have parity with the other approved programs that are administered by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And so, in effect, we do have parity with ignition interlock devices. And it's been quite effective long-term in reducing recidivism and crash rates and a whole host of other benefits that I'm sure you're aware of. But it offering the 24/7 sobriety twice-a-day testing for driver's license reinstatements is a good move. It's an effective move, and it's a move that I'm extremely familiar with, and it's been quite successful in all the other states that are using the 24/7 sobriety program. The idea is these people are driving, and it doesn't matter which vehicle that they're driving, but they're driving sober because they're being tested at least twice a day. And the idea is not to see these people and have them violating laws anymore and our highways safer. And it works as advertised.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. We don't have the amendment in front of us either. It just more was a awareness type thing that we know that's coming. So thank you for your testimony. We have a question, Representative Grunberg.
This is to the chair. We have, and I'm trying to find it, a very recent trial court order from Montana, and it's being appealed to the Montana Supreme Court, And I don't know if this gentleman or somebody else at some point would like to give us what the judge ruled in that state and what's happening.
Okay, thank you for putting it on the record, but we won't stop for that now, Bill. But be thinking about the fact that if you have something on that, get us to us. Elizabeth Ripley and Lucilla.
Mr. Chairman, I will provide the committee with the background information about that, and it is under appeal. And the Attorney General and Governor of the State of Montana are quite confident that the ruling is going to be in favor of the 24/7 sobriety program. And once you have a chance to review the affidavits, I think you'll concur.
That's great. If you would send that information to us, and we'll get it to the committee. And if maybe we could, if you're available on Monday, if you wanted to brief us in more detail on that, it'd be a welcome. And for the record, that was Bill Mickelson again. Seeing no other questions at this time, we're going to go to Elizabeth Ripley and Lucilla.
Representative Keller, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today in favor of SB 64. I'm Elizabeth Ripley, Executive Director of the MADSU Health Foundation, which shares ownership in MADSU Regional and invests our profits back into the MADSU community to improve the health and wellness of Alaskans living in MADSU. We recently completed a MADSU Community Health Needs Assessment, and what we learned is relevant to SB 64. We compiled all the valid and reliable health data on MADSU and then conducted 24 meetings in 2013 with different stakeholder groups and across the MADSU borough. Attendees at these community forums ranked the top five health issues in MADSU. The top five ranked health issues were all behavioral health related. These issues included alcohol and substance abuse, child abuse, access to mental health care, depression and suicide, and domestic violence and sexual assault. We don't believe these issues are unique to MADSU, but are in fact relevant to communities across Alaska. MADSU is home to the new Goose Creek Correctional Center. The majority of those incarcerated suffer from behavioral health issues and will be released back into the MADSU community. We are seeing a meaningful shift across our nation away from incarceration and towards evidence-based smart justice strategies to protect public safety and help Alaskans successfully reintegrate back into our communities. We know the state is concerned about the capital and operating costs of Goose Creek. We need to rethink how we use our criminal justice dollars and the outcomes they yield, and SB 64 does just that. The MADSU Health Foundation in particular supports the sections of SB 64 that increase the felony threshold for property-related crimes, institute the 24/7 sobriety program, institute the PACE program, require the Department of Corrections to conduct a risk needs assessment on all offenders who have been sentenced to 30 days or more, establish a fund for treatment programs that contribute to reducing recidivism, and allow credit for time served in residential substance abuse treatment programs. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of SB 64.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Does any commission, or any, I'm in the wrong place here, any committee members have any questions for Elizabeth? I see none at this time. Thank you for taking time to testify. Any good information? I'm going to go to Betty Baer in Wasilla.
Hi, Representative Keller in the Judiciary Committee. I just want to quickly summarize. I sent in a testimony on Wednesday, and I don't have time to go through any of it at all, except to say that my point when that one was to redefine sexual crime and all the surrounding aspects. You'll need to look at that closely because I have too much else to say today, and I can't even get through what I'm going to say, so I'm sending it to you in writing. But after listening to several testimonies on Wednesday, other issues came to the forefront in my mind. I appreciated the testimonies of two gentlemen indicating that the tendency seems to give punishment and not look at the treatment of an inmate. One testimony indicated that 90% of the crimes are from impaired judgment. Does that really make them a felon? And as you heard Mr. Baer, in his example, if he were charged with that felon, how does that kind of a charge make sense, especially in an intentional and aggravated rape case? It doesn't. Let's redefine sexual crime and not cause a person's life to be ruined forever for someone who is not a real sexual abuser or predator in our society. But the two main issues I really want to address today are what kind of education is really going on in our prisons and how many inmates are getting a career possibility before they exit. I would also like to look closely at what treatment is truly being offered and to how many inmates. I've listened to your committee meetings, and I've listened to the Senate Judiciary Finance Committee meeting, and I'm not getting accurate answers. My question to the legislature, and maybe a challenge, is how many classes are being offered in the education department in the prisons per the number of inmates, per institution? There's a lot of talk about all the education opportunities for inmates, but what is the actual number of inmates that have a career possibility when they leave an institution in comparison to the total number of inmates in that facility? I have a friend who's taken a criminal justice class, and I'm hoping at the MAT soon. I'm hoping she can testify on Monday or Wednesday. They were told at PCC that a lot of educational programs were offered, but even when she called back in, she was just told we're working on getting more classes lined up. So what is really being offered? From her input and other contacts, I have heard of only three career possibilities at PCC: electrician, plumber, and carpentry. And these are only given in minimum, and only two people for each of these classes over an 18-month period of time can have a career possibility. So to me, that's not very many career opportunities for reentry into the world, in the real world. So I'd like to encourage you to look at what is being offered. The other question that I don't feel I'm hearing a real answer to and encourage you to get an answer to is, what treatment is being offered to our inmates in real terms, and how many are able to benefit from it? The one thing that I did hear from my friend and others is that the best program that is offered to inmates for treatment is the TLC program, which is the Transformational Living Community program that is offered in medium security at PCC. But this program is only available in medium security for inmates that are there over 2 years and only for a limited number of people depending upon space. The results from the TLC program are 75% less recidivism after they are released. But that is only in medium. There is not counseling or treatment at minimum. Even from a family, a close friend of mine who is trying to help get help for their family member, they are not even allowed to pay for a counselor to come in and get counseling while the inmate is incarcerated. They have to wait until they are out of jail because nothing is offered. Treatment and counseling are not happening inside. The Recidivism Fund grant is good support for once a person has been released, but the real help needs to be given while they're incarcerated. Help them through their issues all those months of nothing to do but think. There are many viable counselors available, whether it is a certain state-approved or a faith-based counselor. Let this happen while they're inside so their life can begin when they leave. Like the gentleman from Kenai said, if they are following all the rules and have changed, don't hold them to such harsh mandates, like no driver's license and long probation. Give them their life back. Some of them have a tag of felony that will follow them forever, and that is enough to bear. When someone commits a crime, whether it has to do with drinking, drugs, a sexual crime, or theft, the crime then becomes an issue between that person and the state of Alaska. So as the legislature of the state of Alaska, I feel strongly that it behooves you to search for concrete answers to the questions I have presented. As a concerned citizen, and with all respect, due respect to each of you on this committee, I would like to hear some valid answers to the issues I have presented to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Betty, and we do have your written testimony, and Department of Corrections is listening, so I'm sure they will forward us hopefully some information that responds to your questions. Do we have any questions from the committee for Betty? See none at this time. We're going to go next to Lisa Rieger, but just before I do, if you're calling in a second time, we're just going to the ones that are calling in for the first time. We're getting as much testimony as we can in the time allotted. Lisa Rieger, are you online?
I am online. Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. Identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent, and go ahead.
I will. Representative Keller and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Lisa Rieger, General Counsel for Cook Inlet Tribal Council. I also served on the Department of Corrections Reentry Task Force, and I was an associate professor at the UAA Justice Center for 11 years. And we are calling to testifying to support Senate Bill 64, whose efforts really focus on the barriers to success for men and women reentering after incarceration. And the Reentry Task Force really addressed some of those issues as well. And so to increase our success, save the state press's resources, and reduce crime. We support Senate Bill 64 because the legislation provides important new innovations to turn around Alaska recidivism rates. As many have stated already, even our new prison will be beyond capacity soon unless we find a way to address the substance abuse and addiction that leads to so many offenses and particularly to so many violations of probation or parole that also result in incarceration. CETC specifically supports the evidence-based practices of the 24/7 and PACE programs that grew out of the work of the Department of Corrections Reentry Task Force, the Justice Commission, the Recidivism Reduction Fund, which is visionary for long-term stability and represents strategic investments for the state, and the felony threshold for property-related crimes. CETC, in particular, supports the section clarifying credit for time served in residential programs that contribute to reducing recidivism as well. CITC, as many of you know, has been operating Sean Lute, a rehabilitation program for men recently released from prison or substance abuse or homelessness for the past 6 years. Sean Lute is modeled on the successful Delancey Street program from California and operates on the principle that reinforcing accountability for actions, learning a strong work ethic, and responsibility for others is key to turning lives around without the use of professional staff. Our program is a 24/7 residential program located in Anchorage, and since the start of the program, we've served over 175 men and saved the state millions of dollars by housing residents who otherwise would have been in a corrections facility. We have many success stories, of course. Our graduates leave the program having earned everything they have themselves. They have been clean and sober for 2 years. They have a job and the wherewithal to set themselves up with tools, apartment, vehicle, etc., for which they saved in the last months of their residency. Key to the positive impact of the program is both the mandatory work component in our Sean Lute-run businesses and complete responsibility each man has for the maintenance of the house and the program. In fact, income from our Sean Lute businesses support 35% of program expenses. We describe it as learning to live life on life's terms without the use of drugs or alcohol and with taking responsibility for their lives through honest work. Our requirements and expectations for behavior are so high, in fact, that we've had residents who requested to go back to jail rather than complete the program. Given CITC's experience, the opportunities offered in SB 64 align with Sean Lute, and we strongly support the bill. We suggest one change in the recidivism reduction grant program section. There's a requirement in Section C3 for programs to qualify that they have either by referral or inside the program a substance abuse treatment program, and we're suggesting that you add the language if required by assessment. The reason for that is, for example, if an inmate receives treatment inside the institution, he or she may not need treatment during the transition program, and this requirement can be a huge burden both for the programs and for employment schedules for those working in the community. So under those circumstances, only those who really need it should be occupying space in already full substance abuse treatment programs that are on the outside. With that, I am available for questions if you have any, and we really appreciate the steps the legislature is taking to look towards more cost-effective ways of managing our problems without having to keep building prisons. Thank you very much.
Thank you for what you're doing, and I don't see any questions at this time, but I'm sure that your resources will be dependent on as this moves forward. Thank you.
Happy to be of assistance. Thank you.
Melinda Merrill.
Hello, Representative Keller, members of the committee. Thank you very much for taking time to listen to this testimony today. My name is Melinda Merrill. I am the manager of community affairs for Fred Meyer Stores, and I'm here with Scott Bringhurst, our vice president of loss prevention. And we would like to respectfully request that the threshold in Senate Bill 64 be returned to the $750 level. And
I got to say, I have a tremendous amount of respect for the testimony that's just been given before me, and I'm a little sorry we have to come here and be kind of the bad guy on this, but we do have a different perspective in terms of what we deal with, and I'll let Scott Bringhurst address some of this specifically, but what we deal with in our stores at the $500 and $750 level is not kids making one stupid mistake. It's not a kid grabbing a couple things and trying to run out of the store. It's not one-timers that just have bad judgment or peer pressure. It's adults who are, or young adults, who are savvy, who are making a living off of this, who have organized crime rings. And they pay attention to this stuff. They know exactly what our loss prevention strategies are in our stores and what our employees can and cannot do to stop them. They know exactly how much they can steal and what level it's going to put them at in the criminal ranks. And what they're stealing is larger amounts of stuff, or they're walking out with stuff that they know they can get away with, and they're doing it multiple times. And Mr. Bringhurst brought to me an example today, a young guy who we've apprehended 11 times since 2007, and he's stolen almost $3,500 of stuff from us, but he's done it in small increments. Only twice has it been over $500. So he's a career criminal. He's making a living off of this, and there's nothing to stop him. There's nothing to get him into the system and start getting him help and the correction that he needs. So we would really ask that it be put back to the $750 level. We understand the realities out there of the prison system and the costs, but what you do when you raise it that much higher is you assist the career criminals and you give them no place to go. There's no place to get them into the system and start getting them into the resources that Ms. Krieger talked about right before me. So I'm going to hand it off to Scott, if that's okay.
Melinda, before you go, Representative Pruitt has a question for you.
Yeah, Melinda, you may not be able to answer this because it's really a little bit of a hypothetical, but can you help me understand the potential impact in prices to the consumer based on the changes that we're making here? If they're higher dollar amounts and these criminals are able to potentially walk out with higher amounts just everything that you've kind of discussed, how do you think the law-abiding consumer walking into a Fred Meyer, what do you think that will impact their the cost of goods to them?
That's a great question. Thank you. Overall, these kinds of changes in the felony limits absolutely raise the cost of goods for consumers. We're a business. We function in capitalist America. We need to make a profit. We have shareholders. We need to pay our employees good wages because the communities we operate in expect that, and they expect them to earn benefits, and they expect them to be treated well. So we have to make a margin and a profit. So when that level of stuff is walking out of our stores, it absolutely it affects the price of goods. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that we're going to raise the price of goods in Alaska. That's not how the process works. It's spread out overall. But once we raise the price of goods, our competitors raise the price of goods. It's absolutely a snowball effect. And we're in business to stretch our consumers' dollars. We're in business to give them the best deal because we want them to come in and get it from us. So we don't want to raise our prices, and we're not going to do it unless we have to. So this is going to be, obviously we're not going to be the only ones affected by this. Our competitors will be as well, and it absolutely has an effect on consumer prices.
Representative Ledoux has a question for you.
And so I'm assuming that the reason why you would lose money if this threshold were raised was because we're assuming that the police are not going to be investigating as much if the threshold is lower than if the threshold is higher than it is lower?
I'm going to let Scott take that one.
Not so much that they wouldn't investigate it, but the threat of punishment or any type of incarceration is not there any longer. You know, to piggyback a little bit on the answer.
I'm sorry. You need to identify yourself. I had walked away from the mic, but before you speak, give us your name. It makes it easier for the recorder, is all, and who you represent.
I am Scott Bringhurst. I am the Vice President and Director of Loss Prevention for Fred Meyer Stores, based out of Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Scott. We knew that because Melinda told us it was just kind of a formality type thing that we go through, so thank you for doing that. Go ahead and with your response again.
You know, I guess to piggyback on the answer to the previous question, you know, over 2% of our sales today are lost to theft. And you start adding that on and the slim margins that we operate on, it's, at some point in time, it does increase the prices that we have to charge our consumers. Would we target specifically Alaska, as Melinda said, no. The threat of the felony level prosecution or the incarceration is what helps us. We see a great number of thefts that are within a few dollars of the $500 limit in the states that have a $500 limit today. And they truly do learn what the limits are and they take advantage of them. They know that in a lot of cases they'll get a citation. In a lot of cases they won't even be booked or taken to the police station for any type of fingerprinting or identification. The organized groups, as Melinda said, are our biggest problems, and they will take advantage of a raised dollar level.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. I see no other questions at this time, so we're going to go to Tom Butler from Montana. He is a colonel with Montana Highway Patrol, so we're looking forward very much to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Butler, and I'm the current colonel of the Montana Highway Patrol. In 2010, we started a 24/7 pilot program in one county in Montana, and we have now expanded. In 2011, we passed a statewide bill. 2013, we came in and updated that bill to apply to crimes other than second offense DUI. That was our original program, was second offense DUI only. We expanded the program to include crimes where alcohol was a nexus to the crime and the penalty was 6 months or greater potentially for the crime that was committed. We've got the program rolled out to almost 65% of the population in Montana now and are finally getting to the point where we have the ability to sit back and look at some statistics and see if we are having any effect on recidivism with the program that we're running. We, for the most part, mirrored South Dakota's program. And I believe I called in just as Bill Mickelson was finishing his testimony from South Dakota. He's really the father of this whole program or concept as he implemented the first program. But we are anticipating or expecting very similar results to the program in South Dakota. As a side note, in 2013, our alcohol-related fatalities were down by nearly 30% overall. You know, and there's a whole host of factors that play into those alcohol-related fatal crashes. I think we'll see, I'm hopeful we're going to see a similar or at least equal result in the crashes in 2014. I have testified several times in front of several committees up there now, and I've given a complete overview of the program of most of those committees, and I don't want to waste the committee's time today. If there's any specific questions you have about the program as to how we've implemented it here in Montana or how you're looking to implement it up there, I would be more than happy to answer them, but I don't want to bore you with what you may already know.
We appreciate your being succinct, and yes, we have that information available to us, but either having forgotten or never saw this part of it, do you have a limited license program there for DUIs?
Yes, that's part of the, you know, from my experience, this is my 23rd year in law enforcement with the Montana Highway Patrol, and from my experience, due to the geography in Montana, we have no public transportation systems of any substance. In order to live, you have to drive. There's no other way around that in Montana. And we get into this big black hole of suspending people's driver's license for nearly everything under the sun, and it doesn't do any good. There's no, all we do is get them into a driver's license point issue, an insurance issue, a fine issue, and ultimately a jail issue, to some extent, there's people that can never climb out of that hole. So part of the reason that I was excited when we first started talking about the 24/7 program is if you perform well in the program, you have the opportunity to have a driver's license here in Montana. Now, I've not read the specific amendment that came out today in Alaska, but I would encourage you to look very hard at that. I don't have any statistics as to what the suspended driver's license problem is in Alaska, but I would suspect that it's similar to Montana. And it's a problem, it's almost a real good, feel-good issue in my mind that everybody thinks if you take away the driver's license, they're not going to drive, and I'm here to tell you that that is not the case. And if you can keep people sober with this program and give them a restricted driver's license, in my mind, you're doing a great service as far as safety goes to the citizens of Alaska.
Can you give us a little bit of the details as far as actually how it works, you know, with the limited license? Is it misdemeanor DUIs? Is it applied to that? And you said second offense. Just enlarge us a little bit more about that.
So the program in Montana is for DUI specific is for second or subsequent offense. And there's a whole scheme of different driver's license suspensions that are built into that based on the offense and that type of stuff. But if you enter into the 24/7 program, you are then allowed to obtain a restricted driver's license to drive, to work, to the doctor, that type of stuff. Traditionally, here, we have suspended the driver's license. If you were arrested for an offense and ultimately convicted, there was a driver's license suspension that went on with that. That was part of the interesting, or the carrot to the 24/7 program, is if you enter into it, you're given a restricted driver's license as you move through the program. And ultimately, traditionally, those people would have had a driver's license suspension. They're still going to have to go to work. They're still going to have to go to the store. They're still going to have to conduct business in their life. So whether they had a driver's license or not, they were driving. In our case, it's keeping them out of the criminal justice system because they're sober and they still have a driver's license.
Representative Gruenberg has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, the language I believe we're referring to is somewhere around page 21 of the bill. It's the Alcohol and Substance Abuse Monitoring Program. Requires the Commissioner of Public Safety to include in the program and to adopt regulations to implement it. The details for twice a day testing, and that's on page 21, line 13. I realize, sir, you don't have the bill in front of you probably, but that's for the edification of those of us on the committee. My concern is this. Subsection 3 reads as follows, that must be included in the program. Quote, a requirement that the person or offender pay based on the person's or offender's ability under financial guidelines established by the commissioner for the cost of participating in the program. And I don't know if you're the person to ask. You're kind of, as I like to say, a target of opportunity. If you don't know, just tell me and I'll ask somebody who's more knowledgeable. What's the cost of participating in the program?
In Montana, for the twice daily breath testing, it's $2 per test, total of $4 per day. The tests are administered typically between 7 and 9 in the morning and 7 to 9 at night. And we discussed this extensively in 2011 in the legislature, and there was a portion of our legislature that was very nervous regarding the financial implications of this upon a defendant. But I will tell you, in Montana, the average BAC for a DUI arrest is 0.186, I believe. I weigh 200 pounds, and for me to get to that level, depending on whether I was drinking the good stuff or the bad stuff, you're talking $11 to $25 to get to that level of impairment. We have yet to see any sort of financial problems related to this program in all the jurisdictions that it's been rolled out across the state. When we went and visited South Dakota, they made it very clear to us to not get yourself into a credit situation. I stood there in South Dakota and watched people putting pennies and quarters, nickels and dimes, dollar bills to pay for their test. It's just not been an issue in Montana. Because of, and it takes a while for people to understand this, along with regularly daily dosing of alcohol comes a whole host of other vices. And when you take the alcohol away from somebody, I mean, we get letters all the time from people that say that they have more light or more money in their lives now than they've ever had once they sobered up. So we just have not run into a problem here in Montana regarding the $4 per day testing fee.
May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
We'll probably explore that with other witnesses as we review this bill a little more. But we have large areas of the state where there are no roads. And I assume this doesn't apply what I'm wondering, I'm not all that, not familiar enough with this to know how this is going to work. Let's say somebody lives in a village, and they go into Fairbanks, and they get a DUI there, and then they go back in the village. Are they going to have to get tested twice a day, even though they're not going to be driving, or and may very well have a subsistence economy and not have any money at all? They subsist off the land. Colonel, how do you handle that?
You know, the way we looked at that in Montana is, and I can only speak to Montana, and we do not have a similar example in Montana, but we wrote the law gray enough to allow for the judiciary to enter into the program to decide whether or not it was a fit for somebody to go into the 24/7 program. So we relied on that most criminal justice is all local and everybody knows everybody as far as the enforcement side, the prosecution side, and the judiciary to allow them to make those decisions. Obviously, if there are no roads in the village that they live in and they don't have a car in that village, I don't know that there would be a benefit to twice daily testing, simply because there probably isn't going to be enough people in that area to warrant a twice daily testing facility. Now, I can speak a little bit to, we ran the pilot, I mean, as you maybe are aware, we have significant distances in Montana between towns and population centers. Helena is the state capital. 82 miles to the north of Helena is a town called Augusta, which is still inside Lewis and Clark County. And when we ran our pilot program, obviously there's no way we could expect somebody to drive 320 miles in a day to do breath testing. So we chose to enter in with transdermal alcohol monitoring or SCRAM bracelets for those people who geography prevented from being able to access a testing center in a timely and easy fashion. Now, I don't know Alaska's experience with SCRAM and how, if you've utilized that anywhere else in similar situations as you described, but that's how we chose to handle the geographical concerns that these type of programs bring up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel. And we have your contact information, and as questions come up, we'll probably presume the ask you, and appreciate your testimony a lot. Just FYI, the language in our bill leaves room. The word "if practicable" is in there, so to address just exactly the question has been brought up in the rural Alaska. So, okay, let's go to Chris Nettles. And thank you again,
Mr. Chairman.
Chris, if you would identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Sure. My name is Chris Nettles. I'm president of Geotech Alaska and a principal owner of the company.
Give us your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I wanted to address in particular the felony misdemeanor theft level within Senate Bill 64. I am testifying on behalf of my company, myself, as an owner, and the National Federation of Independent Businesses. First off, let me preface, everything I'm going to say is essentially theft is wrong. I don't care about the individuals who've had problems with post-theft. The problem is starts with the theft. And I believe there's even a set of rules given a long time ago that says thou shalt not steal. I just wanted to start off with this, that we understand that what is going on is that theft is wrong. It is really a pet peeve of mine as a business owner. We've had at our company numerous attempts at theft, numerous successful thefts, and it is not being done by just a young person with who is impaired because of drinking, et cetera. These are people who come around, particularly on a Saturday night, through some of these industrial complexes in Anchorage, and help themselves to whatever they can get or steal from the yard or the company, or it, even breaking into the building itself. So I have had numerous problems with it. And the other thing, too, is we do a lot of work for the DOT, state, city contracts, federal contracts. And nowadays, these contracts are getting extremely competitive. And when I say that, we just recently won a $350,000 contract by less than $500.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And I see no questions at this time. So, yes, according to my notes, that gets us through the public testimony on SB 64 today, but we'll leave it open because I'm sure we'll be coming back to it. So, if we're going to change gears here a little bit, we all came with a packet labeled HB 282. And so we're going to proceed with that, even though I sent the signal out that we probably wouldn't get to you. Representative Ledoux?
Would it be possible? I've got a question that I'd specifically like to ask Annie Carpinetti, who's just come in.
Representative Ledoux, about SB 64?
About SB 64.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah, like I have said, we are making SB 64 the priority has to be at this point. This is an important bill. We've got to get it through. Jordan says so. Representative Ledoux, go ahead and ask your question, and Annie can identify herself and respond.
I want to know whether the Department of Law still does plea bargaining in this state. I seem to recall a few, maybe 6 months, a year ago, there was that awful murder in Mountain View, and I thought that there was some talk about no plea bargaining after that. So that kind of fits in with whether you want to. Am I missing something here?
don't mean to. Yeah, it's a great question, Representative Ledoux. It's just that it has been on the radar screen, you know, so yeah, I'm sure we'll get a good answer.
I'm just trying to figure that if you set a threshold for theft as lower, for example, does the Department of Law have discretion, and do they use that discretion to enter into plea bargaining for maybe first offenders, second offenders, et cetera? Or is there no plea bargaining whatsoever?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I would be better prepared to answer that question if I'd known it was coming up. But I can tell you generally that we do continue to plea bargain certain cases. We no longer do we sentence bargain on certain cases, and that is agree on a sentence to serious, generally in-person crimes like assault, homicide, that sort of crime. But I believe we are still both sentence bargaining and plea bargaining, charge bargaining on property cases like theft.
Okay.
But I ask for the indulgence to correct that if I need to go back and review our policy.
All right. I'd appreciate getting some clarification on that for sure.
Yeah. Generally, I don't think that the no sentence bargaining provision applies to theft type cases, but I will double check and make sure that's correct.
All right, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
It's a very appropriate question. It is. It's in all our minds. We're not sure we have the answer, but Representative Grunberg.
To follow up on exactly that, could you give to us in writing the various kinds of bargainings, the definitions, because I get very confused, and that would be a little bit of a glossary. And then a statement as to what the department's policy is, because I'm confused as to the definition, and I'm confused as to the policy. And it's just a general question. And as long as I'm asking that, Mr. Chair, Ms. Carpinetti, I'm also confused. You have different kinds of immunity. Mm-hmm. And if you could do the same for the definition of the different kinds of immunity, that will be helpful for me to have, because that comes up from time to time on both the bargainings and the immunities. I know you don't have policies. Maybe you do have policies on the immunities, too, but that will let us know what at least the current what the definition is and what the current administration's policies are.
And before you answer, if you would, anything you produce in writing in response to that question, I would very much appreciate having it for the committee.
Or to the chairman.
And we'll pass it on.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether I don't know whether I can respond to that the way you would like to. Immunity is not something that we have a policy on. It's the law.
It's not just a definition.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay.
We don't have the chair.
We don't have a policy of whether or not to do immunity, because that's what the law requires us to do.
Okay.
Thank you for letting us put you on the spot on the spur of the moment.
You're right.
Thank you. We don't do that often, right?
No.
the only bargains I know is Nordstrom's.
HB 282, sponsor, please come forward. I would like to just state, why don't we get a motion to get the version. It's a sponsor substitute that we have before us, and I think what we have in the paperwork, he's going to be telling us here, but I think we have version P in front of us. It's a CS, Labor and Commerce CS, and then there's going to be some proposed amendments, but let's put P on the table so we all work on the same page. So. Vice Chair?
Let me look at
you. You want me to do this?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill, CS of House Bill 282, Labor and Commerce, 28-LS0930/P, ready for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Doug Isaacson. I'm representative from District 1, North Bowl Eielson, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Brenda Hewitt. I know that this is an extremely busy day, and we've got 12 minutes, so I'm going to rush through a brief introduction and then ask Brenda to run through the sectional and explain where the amendments will come. So I appreciate that you've allowed us to address this and at least get the process underway. As you know, the relationship between a landlord and a tenant is, it predates history. Who knows when it first started, but it's as old as time. Conflicts arise when either party has unmet expectations, and most people can describe what a poor landlord is, and many can even say what a good landlord is, or what a great tenant does, or what a bad tenant does. But how do you codify this? How do you put that relationship, a good relationship especially, into law? This is the never-ending bill, because as we have brought it forward, we've been having a lot of amendments. And I'm not married to this bill, just to let you know, to give you a history of it. It started for me back in the early 90s when I had a program called Tenant Watch. I created that as part of our services with Credit Services, Inc. at the time, a TransUnion credit bureau. And I had 700 landlords who had asked me to help change the law because there were things that were unfair to them. And at the same time, I had people coming off the street who would ask us to help them because they had bad landlords. So it kind of worked out as a good experience. And I took the issue to Jeanette James, who was my predecessor as representative for North Pole. And back in 93 or so, we were able to address this body, all of our predecessors, I assume, and we had some substantive changes. Well, 20 plus years have evolved, and this last year, through a series of coincidences, residents and landlords, primarily from my district, and then everywhere, it just kind of. I was like a magnet. My office was a magnet, and we attracted everybody's attention and the state's as well. And so it was. There was concern that in the intervening time there had been changes that needed tweaking. So I'm appreciative of the broad support this bill has received so far from realtors, landlord, property managers, and tenant advocacy groups to date, and I hope you'll amend and pass this bill out so that we can bring relief to the legal in the legal system to landlords, victims of domestic abuse, and tenants alike. So without further ado, if I could ask Brenda Hewitt to put herself on the record and walk you through the sectional.
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Representative Grunberg has a question for you.
Just a housekeeping question. I've got several folders with different versions here, and it looks to me like the operative thing originally was the N version, which was the bill as introduced. And now we're at the P version, which is the Labor and Commerce Committee substitute. However, I seem to find floating around in here a sectional analysis for a version I don't have, the O version. Should I toss that sectional analysis?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, O will get you almost all the way through P, with the exception of one amendment that was added in Labor and Commerce.
Thank you.
This is Brenda Hewitt, staffer, Representative Isaacson. Okay.
Oh, yeah, identify yourself. Yeah, okay. Great. Before you identify yourself and give us your testimony, I just want to give the committee what we got here in the last few minutes. We have Ed Sniffen online from the Department of Law, who's there for questions, if we have one for him. And we also have Lisa from the Alaska Network for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault here in the room, who wants to testify today. So,
and if I could, as a matter of housekeeping, Mr. Chair, this is Doug Isaacson for the record. Note that Monday is Seward's Day, and so many state offices will be closed. So if we do have time to get to Ed, that would be extremely beneficial.
Well, it sounds like a good day to get things through. If you would identify yourself and go through the section.
My name is Brenda Hewitt. I am a staff for Representative Doug Isaacson from House District 1. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. The housekeeping piece at the very beginning, sections 1, 2, 3, and actually back to 17, just take the word uniform out of the bill. It's we no longer will fit under what's considered the Uniform Landlord-Tenant Act. There were only 21 states that had enacted the uniform law to begin with, and they are currently under revision as we speak. In section 4, landlord and tenant, replace the word parties. In sections 5 and 9, we're talking about pets. And what we're doing is we're allowing landlords to actually bump up the amount of deposit they can put on a residence or a dwelling if somebody wants to have pets. So now instead of having a 2-month cap, they can go up to a 3-month cap. Again, landlord-tenant relationship is, if you have an agreement with your landlord, can be utilized. The Landlord-Tenant Act is sort of a default in case somebody doesn't have an agreement. So,
if you would, let me interrupt you a little bit and let Representative Grunberg ask his question. But in general, let's try to let them make the whole presentation.
You're a little faster than me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you could, just so I can follow along, what section are we talking about pets in?
Okay, right now we're talking about, for pets, there's actually two sections that deal with it. Section 5. And again on section 9, so there's two. Because one is allowing that cap to be raised, and in section 9, it's actually dealing with what we're addressing.
And Representative Grunberg, thank you for that question. I realize now I was lost too.
So. I apologize. Okay. Here, it's the speed of time.
Okay.
My apologies.
I see. Okay, because it references subsection. Oh, I see. Back over here.
I see.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Thank you both.
Section 6 is dealing with the definition of normal wear and tear, and this was something that was asked for by both tenants and by landlords. We didn't have a definition for normal wear and tear, but it's often the language that is used to describe wear and tear on just normal sort of be able to use a place and what it looks like renting a car. Section 7 changes a semicolon to a period. It is actually asking the landlord to separately account for the tenant's prepaid rent and security deposits. Already in law is requiring people to put that money into a trust form. What we're asking is that they actually, on an accounting basis, keep track of it. So For instance, if I have an apartment building and I rent it to somebody in 1972, and my gosh, their deposit was only $500, but now my rents have increased and it's $750. Well, I still am keeping track of the fact that he only has $500 in there. And if somebody in another apartment moves out, I can't take their money and use it to repair this particular. I've got to make sure I've got enough money in there to cover. If everybody left, I should be able to have enough money to pay back my tenants when they leave. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Are you going to take questions? I do have a question on this, or do you want us to wait? What's your question?
We're going to have to wait. I would like to take questions. I have some myself. But if you would just make note of them in the by the line and page, and we will get back to it.
Okay.
Yeah, because I have questions too, but if we get caught there, we won't get the testimony and people will come to testify.
My apologies.
So go ahead. No, it's all right.
In Section 8, it's saying that the landlords have up to 30 days to return a security deposit if there's been damage. This gives them enough time to assess what the damage is prior to having to return the funds, and 14 days wasn't sufficient time. Section 9 is actually dealing with our pet deposits. It also is starting to get into the definition of service animals versus comfort animals, which seem to be an issue for a number of landlords. Section 10 is actually requiring the tenants and the landlords to have a condition, premise condition statement. Like when you go to rent a car, you both agree what the condition of the car is before you rent it. So if there's any damage, you can both say, oh, well, you're right, I've got a chip in the windshield now. Section 11 is the permitting dry cabins if both parties agree. That means that you, in the uniform law, you are required to have hot running water. And in some places in Alaska, we don't have hot running water, and people actually like it that way. Section 12 allows the landlord to restrict the number of inhabitants in a dwelling by law, and you'll notice that you do have an amendment that's addressing that particular section. In the four amendments that have been offered, we are in favor of all four of them, so that I just wanted to make sure that you knew that.
Mr. Chair, just a parliamentary inquiry.
Representative Grubert?
Just for the record, we have, at least I have in front of me, amendments P1 through P5, but there's no P2.
Oh, okay.
Is that right?
That comes up to four, so I think we're probably going to.
I just want to be sure.
You're right. Actually, there was, when we had law draft one of them, they came back with a different version of it. I think, yeah, P3 replaced P2, and so we didn't submit that one.
Thank
you for noticing.
Sure.
Good eyes. Section 13 asks the tenant to leave the premise in substantially the same condition if they had the carpets professionally cleaned. They should be able to ask for those to be professionally cleaned when they're done. Section 14 is an important one. It's actually allowing victims of domestic violence to be able to leave the facilities or the dwelling with almost immediacy. But there has to be quite a number of items that they have to do. Like if it has to be a for sure violent act where they've actually gone to the police and they filed a report and they're turning that in. So they can't just claim that something's been happening and that's how they can get out of their rent quickly. But if there's a real victim case, we want them to be able to have that empathy. So
I got a question.
Yeah, what we'll do is quickly ask the question. We may not get answered because of the time. The testifier, Lisa, has said she'll wait till next time too. So go ahead.
You can come back to answer, but I just want to be clear that we're truly talking about in this case domestic violence towards one of the individuals in there. Just keep it as a question I have, real life situation. The partner of the individual commits some sort of crime or has some sort of problem, that he was the breadwinner, and then what happens? It's not domestic violence, but it's still some sort of crime is taking place. Now they can't pay for it because the breadwinner is gone. I don't know. It's a little different. I don't know if it would somehow be in the same vein.
That's a great question, Representative Isaacson, through the chair to Representative Pruitt. It's a great question. I don't believe that exact scenario is covered by this, but I know that Lisa, when she testifies, can address that, and Ed Sniffen, I believe, also would be the proper one. But for sake of time, I don't
think. And they can just wait till Monday to answer that, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah.
Okay. Gabriel. I'm going to keep track of the question, and my staff is right on the ball, too, so I'm sorry. Oh, Representative.
Yeah. I'm just a little bit concerned here. Okay, so under the domestic violence, so suppose somebody is ultimately acquitted of the accusation of domestic violence. How does that work? Because now the lease has already been terminated. If the complainant, if the person who is supposedly perpetuates the domestic violence, if that person is acquitted, would the lease get reinstated? Would somebody have to pay the damages? I mean, how would that work?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, my way of reading this is that the perpetrator may still be staying in the dwelling. You're not kicking out necessarily both parties, but you're allowing that first person who's had the violence, who's a victim, you're allowing them out of the financial requirement.
And that's a great question for the record. And Ed Sniffen, can you get him to come back when we get a chance to address this again so that he can address that and maybe shed some light too? Is that all right with you?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Last two sections, I'll go quickly. Section 15 is allowing a landlord to get somebody out for illegal activities. For instance, there's a crack house. You can get them out in 24 hours instead of the 14 days that it takes now. Section 16 gave a definition to transient occupancy. I think you have an amendment before you to remove that, and we understand that. Section 18 is dealing with the ability of the landlord to attach the PFD of a tenant that owes them money. And that's my sectional.
Okay.
And if I could, just as a wrap-up, to keep in mind, Representative Isaacson, to the chair, what we're trying to do is create safe, affordable housing. To do that, you have to give protections to the landlord to be able to recoup expenses and to be able to protect the other tenants. And safe and affordable housing also means you have to be able to protect tenants and provide them with protection against abusive landlord situations. Caveat with this is that this is the fallback. If you have a tenant-landlord contract that is specifying certain damages, if you have to pay for this according to a schedule or something, this doesn't disallow the contract with landlords if as long as it doesn't do an end around the intent of the law. What this does do is establish a relationship that oftentimes is not understood or is intentionally abused and maybe not even covered in contract. Thank you.
Representative Groomer, you had a question?
Just two very brief things. Number one, in the things that must be in, who gets what back, one thing I think is important to state is if the security deposit prepaid rental is put into an interest-bearing account and gets a little interest, I think there should be a provision in there that allows the landlord to keep any interest. So otherwise, you're giving pennies back to all kinds of people. And number two, and this is something that I really am concerned, a little bit concerned about, is Section 17 and the relationship between this and the Uniform Act. I'll want you to go into at some point what is making this no longer uniform, particularly if they're going to come up with a revised Uniform Act or something. We are in the process of regularly looking at Uniform Acts, and if they're going to come up with a new act, I want to be careful that we try to see what we can do to keep it uniform. That's very helpful, because then we get decisions from states all over the country. And secondly, if there are just a few sections that make it non-uniform, then most of it will still look at the Uniform Act. And that's why I'm concerned about having a title here, which may mislead people. We'll have to talk about that, and we can talk privately. But I'd like some updating on that. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And to the chair on that, we were. This is part that Representative Isaacson to the chair. Yes, through the chair to Representative Grunberg. But this is one of those that legal asked us to remove, and so they would have the definitive explanation why this is not uniform.
Mr. Chair, we'll have to talk with you.
And I just want to state on the record before we gavel out that. SB 64, the crime bill, is a big deal. We're making it a priority in this committee. We want your bill, you know, to get a fair hearing, and we'll do the best we can. But the only reason I mention that is work out the questions that have been raised today with the people that have raised them as much as you can outside of committee, and that will make it go quicker when we can get back. But there has to be a there's a list, you know, so we'll get back to it as soon as we can, but I can't make promises as to when at this point.
Sure. Chair Keller, Representative Isaacson, if members could email us their questions, we'll make sure that we have answered and provided written down, and so you can pass this out within 15 minutes, get it to the floor and over to the Senate so we can pass it out this year.
I would suggest, Representative Isaacson, it'll probably take more than an email, but you know, you have excellent staff, and I'm sure we can get there. Okay, with that, we're going to close out at 3:07. Thank you.